Do you know what time it is? It's supernatural story time. And if you're easily scared, and even if you're not, there's only one thing left to do. Just turn off the lights, because these are stories that you listen to only in the dark. Grandpa's house. I'll be honest, I never really liked my mom. She was weird and sort of creepy and always punished me. But I was an only child and had my own room, and Friday nights were sacred to me. I'd hole up in my room with a stack of the latest Marvel comics and a bag of Jelly Bellies, and shit could have been worse. This is about one Friday when shit was worse, much worse. It all started when my mom told me on Thursday night I'd be sleeping over at Grandpa's house that Friday. I flat out refused, but was threatened with 7 levels of hell if I did not go, and was promised that my grandpa's creepy wife with a bouffant hairdo would not be there, and that Grandpa had gotten a brand new color TV. Big fucking shit. Grandpa was a negative dick. The kind of dick who'd give you a present and then wonder out loud, let's see how long it takes him to break this one. But his daughter, my mother, was if nothing a chip off the old dick. So it was a choice between one night in Doucheville with color TV or a whole month of punishment. Running away was not an option, as my net worth was not quite the princely sum of $8.50, and where would I run anyway? So on Friday came and Grandpa showed up to get me. Out the door I went. True to my mother's word, his ghastly wife with a bouffant hairdo and giant wart on her schnozzel was working the night shift somewhere, probably auditing the books at the Elvira Mansion, and his legless mother-in-law, more on that later, was confined to a room at the back of the bus. So I said to myself, me? Looks like it might not be so bad. Watch a little telly and back tomorrow in time for baseball and that stack of comic books I was jonesing on. At about 8 p.m., just as we were finishing up our nutritiously delicious Hungry Man TV dinners, it seemed my biggest dilemma of the night was whether we were going to be watching Donnie and Marie or The New Adventures of Wonder Woman. Now, personally, I was all about Wonder Woman, but Marie did have those big DSLs. So, yeah, my survival was looking most assured. Grandpa, who taught junior high school in the inner city, was bitching about the Schwartzes as usual. That's a derogatory, neurotic Jew speak for black people. But I was more concerned with watching a big green giant at 9 p.m. on Channel 2, known as The Incredible Hulk. It was the best of times. It was about to become the worst of times. Just as Linda Carter was about to make her debut, the telephone rang. My grandpa answered and came back into the living room a few minutes later, just as I was starting to think impure thoughts about what I'd like Wonder Woman to do to little me with that big rope. Get your coat. We have to go out to Long Island. Louise's brother-in-law died. Cocksucking motherfucking 2 tons, bitch. How the fuck did I know going to Grandpa's house was going to make my barely pubescent titty balls itch? So in the Dodge Dart we go, and on to the LIE, off to who can remember where. All I know is no Incredible Hulk, no Wonder Woman, and there would be a corpse involved. Well, on the way I noticed my grandpa's sweating profusely and guzzling cans of diet soda, one after the other, and apparently having trouble with his eyes as he's driving. That meant the car swerved once too many times and his nerves were becoming my nerves. I cursed my mother. Yet we managed to arrive in one piece to a suburban house that looks like all other suburban houses. In we go to be greeted by my grandma Drusilla, a wife. Turns out she had a sister with a blue bouffant to complement her white bouffant. Sir, like Marge, only without the kindness. Well, it turns out Marge's husband was sitting on the porch with their developmentally disabled 20-year-old son when he apparently decided, fuck this, I'm out of here. Probably had a massive coronary. Thing was, because his son was not there, if you catch my drift, he just kept talking to Daddy Deadest. And talking. Apparently, this talking to the Dutch stick went on for an hour or two till the wife got home and realized Daddy didn't really give a shit what was for dinner that Friday night. Now, the thing was, the son didn't know his father wasn't just napping to escape their convo, and apparently nobody thought he was capable of handling the news. So when I got to there promptly, locked me in the basement with him and told me to talk to him about cars. He liked cars. I didn't know shit about cars except that I almost died myself in one just a couple of hours ago. And now I found myself trapped in a basement with a strange bird who could apparently talk grown men to death. TGI to the motherfucking F. Yeah, so for the next 3 hours, while the grown-ups taking care of shit upstairs. I was a captive audience to Mario Andretti of the... All right, I'll keep it light. Let's just say he was a close talker. And not only did I get the car and driver report for 1978, I got the AccuWeather report too. How far could $8.50 get me? So finally, interminably, somehow, it was eventually time to leave. In the car, my grandpa's scary-ass wife started promptly yelling about him not taking his insulin. What the fuck? And driving. Seems grandpa's proclivity for a lifetime of TV dinners, cigars, and Snickers bar had then caught up to him. And like those Amazonian fish, he was in denial. Well, she forces him to get off the highway somewhere so she can drive, and it turns out she can't really drive. I mean, she has a license, but that don't mean she can get the job done. So now grandpa's sweating and screaming, and she's sweating and screaming, and the car's swerving and screaming, and I'm sitting in the backseat thinking, fuck, I should have took the punishment. After what seems like a lifetime, we get back to grandpa's house and walk in the front door to a sight I will never forget. On the kitchen floor with a pair of shit-covered wooden legs is Great Granny Bouffant. Now, speaking of diabetes, it turns out that she had it and several years ago was going to have one of her legs amputated. Can you guess what happened? Yuppers. Cut the wrong leg off. Now, everybody hated this lady. But she was rich from the malpractice suit, so they kept her around in the back room waiting for her to kick the bucket herself so they could inherit the leg money. Only that night there was nobody to feed her, so she took it upon herself to locomote to the kitchen for some snackage, and her legs came out from under her, and gravity can't be blamed for doing its thing. Of course, then she had to take a big old supersized shit. This is before supersizing it was the shit. And since they didn't have those I've fallen, I can't get up dealios, she stayed down in the shit. Yep, I shit you not. So the house smelled like shit. I almost vomited, but fuck it. I swallowed my bile. A kid's got to become a man sometime, right? And that's why I'm never sleeping over at Grandpa's house again. It's my room. I want to paint my room turquoise, 10-year-old me cheerfully announced over my ham steak. It's not your room, Damien. It's the guest room. My father's 20-year-old wife, Betty Jo, informed me, her dumbass mouth full of mashed potatoes and gravy. Nuh-uh. It's my room, right, Dad? Herman's lower lip seemed reluctant to part with its upstairs neighbor. No, it's not, Damien. It's the guest room. Your room is at home with your mother. Betty Jo insisted, gracing me with yet another eyeful of her mashed potatoes and gravy-filled pie hole. Dad, it's my room, right? 'Cause you said. Doesn't really matter, kiddo. It's just a room. My fence-walking fuckwad of a dad philosophized. No, Damien. It's the guest room, and I do not want it turquoise. Turquoise is a dumb color, and that is that. I can't say I was liking the way my first vacation ever was turning out. Betty Jo, Herman, and I were staying at some inn up in the mountains of Vermont. Well, like the saying goes, you can take the kid out of Brooklyn, but you can't take the Brooklyn out of the kid. Hey, Betty Jo, you really think turquoise is a dumb color, huh? I don't think it, I know it. Oh, yeah? I bet you can't even spell dumb, I said, throwing down the gauntlet. Of course I can, dumb, D-U-M, dumb. Betty Jo seemed unduly pleased with her spelling abilities. That's not how you spell dumb, dummy, I informed her between peals of guffaw. It has a B at the end, which is silent. You know, Betty Jo, you could probably learn a lot from that B. There's no B in dumb, right, Herman? Herm? The waitress brought us our drinks. She set my root beer down in front of me and asked, How are you tonight, cutie pie? I smiled at her. She had curly red hair and giant knockers and looked like the future. Can I ask you a question? I asked her, smiling. Sure, hon. What's your pleasure? How do you spell dumb? Betty Jo glared at me. Herman looked like he had a bus to catch. The waitress smiled. I liked her smile. A lot. D-U-M-B. Anything else I can do for you, sweetie? Nope. Thank you. The waitress made her exit. Betty Jo said, We're not painting the guest room turquoise, Damien. And that is that. Right, Herman? My father was not enjoying this. Well, this fucking chagrin was my rock me Amadeus. Ever since he picked up 16-year-old Betty Jo, the hitchhiking word wizard, on a Brooklyn street in 1969, she had been a thorn in my side. Betty Jo had an opinion on just about fucking everything. The only thing they all had in common was each one was shittier than the last. Now, you don't have to take my word for it. Let me give you a for instance. When I first met Betty Jo Fuckface, I was 6 years old and my parents had recently called it quits on their sham of a you can't get drafted to the NAM if you have a wife and kid union. I was spending the weekend at my dad's shithole bachelor pad, the one that had redwood tree-sized splinters sticking out of the floor and steroid-enhanced roaches goose-stepping through the kitchen. As I recall, I was amped to take a bath with Mr. Bubble and read my new stack of comic books, and otherwise escape the cloud of pot smoke and banal conversation that Herman and Betty Jo spewed wherever they went. He can't take a bath alone, Herman. He's too young. I know how to take a bath, Betty Jo, I said, shaking my head in disbelief. Herman, I'm giving him a bath, and that is that. I don't want him drowning or walking around with a stinky coolie because he doesn't know how to wash right. I'm giving you your bath, and that is final. Now, let's get your stinky coolie to the bathroom. Dad, do I have to? Betty Jo will give you your bath. I nodded. So tonight, we're all going to play. Let's humiliate six-year-old me, huh? Well, to can play at that little game. Fine, I said, with a too bright smile as usual. Nobody noticed. 5 minutes later, naked me was standing barefoot on the dirty bathroom floor while Betty Jo started running the water. I had to take a serious whiz, but to this day, I could never go with an audience unless, of course, I was pissing on my girlfriend's titties, but I digress. Bottom line, I was a boy who appreciated his privacy, not to mention a little respect as in R-E-A-S-P-E-C-T. Betty Jo was going to find out what that means to me. Do you have to go tinkle before your bath, Damien? Betty Jo asked. Nope. You sure? Yep. I was sitting in the bath and Betty Jo was coming for me with the washcloth. My little six-year-old wiener stood at 10 hut. Betty Jo, the mouth breather, swooped in for my coolie, pot-glazed eyes, ready for the kill. I gave the command. Peeny Weeny loosed the cannon. Bullseye. There was a gurgling sound followed quickly by, Herman! Oh! Betty Jo ran for cover as I continued to empty my bladder in a wide arc that rang down on the bubbles. I looked at Mr. Bubble and said, You do make getting clean ones as much fun as getting dirty. Mr. Bubble did not disagree. So now that I got that, for instance, out of the way, hopefully you now have some small context as to just how little I appreciated being informed by Betty Jo that my room was not, in fact, my room, but rather that I was merely a guest in my own father's house. It's my room, and I am painting it turquoise, Betty Jo, and that is that. Herman! Later, we were back in the motel room with the Smothers Brothers on the shitty black and white TV. I was laying on the bed naked under a blanket, having just finished my Mr. Bubble bath, unassisted, I might add. There was a knock at the door. Betty Jo sprang up to answer it and walked a couple of dirty hippie guys. One of them had a big brown bag under his denim-clad arm. 5 minutes later, they were weighing out a mountain of weed on a triple beam balance scale. Who's the kid? One of the hippies asked. I treated it like a rhetorical question, but Betty Jo chimed in. That's Herman's son, Damien. Damien, come here and say hello. Hello. That's not how we say hello. Stand up and shake, what did you say your name was? Betty Jo asked, bouncing her tube-top titties at hippie number one. Phineas. Show some manners and stand up and shake Phineas' hands, Damien. No, I'm okay, I said, turning my attention to the shitty TV. Betty Jo walked over to me and pulled me out of the bed by the arm. Hippie number two said, Oh, naked in the bed. I can dig it, little man. I punched Betty Jo's left titty. Dad! Herman! Herman passed Betty Jo a big joint and said, This shit is primo, man. Got back under the blanket, wishing I had my dolomite underoos on. Phineas took out two sheets of acid and said, Hey, man, you want to be careful with this shit. Only take a half and wait like a couple of hours, man. My girl took three hits last night and she's still making what the freak. 10 minutes later, the dirty hippies were gone, and Betty Jo and my father were in the shower together, the motel room a cloud of weed smoke. I knocked on the bathroom door. Not now, Damien, Betty Jo shouted. I poked my head in the bathroom, and I could see my dad doing something dirty to Betty Jo's coolie. You sure I can't paint my room turquoise? It's not your room, it's the guest room. I sat back on that bed pissed, but even then I knew revenge was a dish best served cold, or perhaps it was a beverage. On the bedside table were a couple of plastic cups of Jack and Coke Herman and Betty Jo had been drinking from. I went into my dad's denim jacket and took out one of the sheets of acid. I had pictures of Snoopy on them. As if, hey man, you want to be careful with this shit. I folded the sides of the sheet, carefully peeling off 20 hits from the blotter. I folded those over again, splitting them into two strips of 10 hits each. I placed them on the bedside table next to their drinks. I then carefully replaced the remainder of the blotter back in Herman's jacket. From the bathroom, I could hear Herman grunting and Betty Jo grunting. I'll give you just one more chance, bitch. Once again, now like Sisyphus, I opened the bathroom door just enough to poke my head in. Betty Jo was on her knees and Herman had her by the hair. I really, really, really want to paint my room turquoise. That cinched it. I carefully took one of the strips of acid, placing it under the ice with my finger and stirring it around. I pulled it out and it was pretty soggy. Just for good measure, I stirred it some more with my finger and then placed a soggy strip of paper on a napkin. Then I rinsed and repeated with the other plastic cup. When I was satisfied with my bartending, I threw the crumpled napkin in the waste paper basket. 10 minutes later, Betty Jo and Herman were drying off and parading around the room in the buff. Herman had another joint going. I holed up under my blanket, watching an episode of Columbo. Betty Jo was putting on some very red lipstick in the mirror. I looked at a reflection and said, it's not the fucking guest room. It's my room, and I'm gonna paint it turquoise. This fucking kid doesn't know when enough is enough. I need a fucking drink. Where's my drink? Betty Jo picked up her Jack and Coke. Columbo said, just one more thing. Pass me my drink, BJ, Herman said. Betty Jo passed Herman the other Jack and Coke. And now we wait. About half an hour later, Herman, Betty Jo, and I were watching Rosemary's Baby on the shitty TV. My father was fucking with the antenna, mostly saying, fucking shit TV. Betty Jo said, a little more to the left. Betty Jo suddenly looked at her pointed figure, horrified. She waved her hand some more and traced it with very big eyes. Rosemary, looking just like Betty Jo, said, oh God, oh God. Betty Jo said, oh God, oh God. Herman was getting on a chair and trying to do something with tin foil when he said, oh wow, man. Probably fell on his ass. He stayed on the carpet saying, whoa, 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 man. Betty Jo started hugging herself, rocking back and forth. Herman, something's wrong. The lady on TV said, come with us quietly, Rosemary. Don't argue or make a scene, because if you say anything more about witches or witchcraft, we're going to be forced to take you to a mental hospital. You don't want that, do you? I went to the bathroom and got my bottle of Mr. Bubble. I returned to the room. Herman and Betty Jo were rolling around on the floor moaning. Herman was holding his head, just saying, oh God, the pliers. The dentist has pliers, pliers. Betty Jo was clutching at her tube top. I held Mr. Bubble over her face. It's my room, me and Mr. Bubble. Now, you don't want to make any trouble for Mr. Bubble, do you, Betty Jo? Herman! Rosemary said, you're lying. It didn't die. You took it. You're lying, you witches. You're lying. You're lying. You're lying. You're lying. I walked to the window and opened it wide. The chilly Vermont air filled the room. I got down on the floor with Betty Jo. I held Mr. Bubble over her face. Betty Jo's eyes were bulging. My best Mr. Bubble voice, I whispered in her ear. Mr. Bubble wants you to fly, Betty Jo. It ended up sounding more like Grover from Sesame Street. Betty Jo's eyes bulged. Rosemary said, pain, be gone. I will have no more of thee. Betty Jo said, pain, be gone. I will have no more of thee. Let me help you up, Betty Jo. Where are we going? Betty Jo asked. Your guests are waiting, BJ. You don't want to keep your guests waiting, do you? I even think Phineas will be there. Betty Jo perked up. I put her arm around my shoulder and helped her chase down perpendicularity. You get some fresh air, Betty Jo. You'll be right as rain. Betty Jo just kept muttering. The guest room. Mustn't keep the guest waiting. The guest room. The guest room. Careful, Betty Jo. Don't want to step on Herman. Betty Jo looked down at Herman. Hi, Herm, she said. I mustn't keep the guest waiting. No, no, please. Not the pliers, doctor. A floss, I swear. We carefully stepped over Herman, who continued his experiments with various contortions. Herman's knuckles were white, where he clutched his head, endlessly moaning about pliers and the dentist and dental floss. Only he said it like floss. Over by the window, I stood with Betty Jo's arm around my shoulder. I stretched out my arm, gesturing at the full Vermont moon. It's time to fly, Betty Jo. Mustn't keep your guest waiting. Time to fly, she said. Mr. Bubble wants you to be free, Betty Jo.
Free, she muttered, getting out on the ledge. Free as a bird, Betty Jo. Fly away, little birdie. Your guests are waiting. Fly away, little birdie. We mustn't keep our guests waiting. You had best prepare the guest room. A gust of chilly Vermont air blasted back my hair. My eyes locked with Mr. Bubbles. He smiled at me like a favorite son. Rosemary said, Witches, you're all witches. Betty Jo teetered out on the ledge, her left tit hanging out of her tube top, nipple hard, flopping in the chilly wind, a faint bruise visible in the moonlight from where I punched her. Wait for it, Mr. Bubble. Fly free to the guest room, Betty Jo mumbled to nobody in particular. The guests are waiting, must prepare their room. We mustn't keep the guest waiting. That would be D-U-M. Must fly free, must fly. Wait for it, Mr. Bubble. Free! Betty Jo landed with a dull thud on the pavement four floors below. I filled my lungs with icy fresh mountain air, the full moon illuminating vistas heretofore unseen. Below I could hear a couple of women scream hysterically. I smiled at Mr. Bubble. Good job, Mr. Bubble. Mr. Bubble did not disagree, but instead replied, I did it all for you, Damien. All for you. And that was the last I ever heard about my room being the guest room. Don't fuck with Mr. Bubble. The Unknown Building. I'm a 19-year-old woman and I live in a city whose name I won't say, so don't bother asking. I work at an old bookshop near downtown, and a four-floor building suddenly appeared. And when I say overnight, I mean it literally. The building is set in an abandoned lot that has been vacant since 1978, as far as I could find, until last Thursday. It was an empty lot, but on Friday, a four-story building appeared there out of nowhere. There were no walls on it, so everyone could see the whole lot was empty, and a building just appeared there. It's a four-floor building, a hospital to be more specific. I concluded that just looking at the outside and the inside, as later I saw, proved this to be true. That looked absolutely decrepit, and a tall metal fence protected the lot. I tried taking pictures of it, but mysteriously every picture I took was deleted by my cell phone. Don't even say I imagined it. It made the news that day. Everyone wanted to understand what and how people built something so big in such a short time and make no noise. We were fucking astonished. No explanations were found, though, and so people started trying to get on the inside. Police tried to stop us, obviously. They tried to convince everyone everything was fine by saying it was private property and blah, blah, blah. Most quit at this point, but some made it. The first one to get inside was a boy I went to high school with. His name was Jacob. And we hadn't heard from him since that Friday night. So a friend, Gerard, and I went to check the hospital. And yesterday night, we made it inside. We planned this earlier that day and brought with us flashlights, compasses, real ones, not cell phone compasses, cereal bars, and water. We were ready to go at 6 p.m. The dusk and darkness of night would cover us. And 50 miles later, we passed through the tall grass, covering everything and entered the building itself. This looks like those cheap horror movie scenarios, Gerard said. I had to agree, everything was old, cheap, and dirty. But as I knocked in a wall, I knew it was concrete. Very real to me. The mold smell was very real, too. Disgusting. We wandered through the first floor in dead silence. The dusk was almost over, and the absence of light made us uneasy. Scared as fuck, to be honest. It was indeed creepy. We turned on flashlights and found the first locked door since, at the left side of the corridor. The brilliant idea to open it was mine. There were some beds in the room, empty and stained with what seemed to be blood, but the last one was behind a curtain, and we could see a human silhouette sitting on the bed as we flashed the light of the flashlights. My first idea was to think it was Jacob. He has always been a prankster after all. So I had none of this bullshit and headed to the bed. Jacob, that's not funny at all. Your parents are fucking crazy after you. He didn't answer. Gerard was nervous. He held my hand and tried to get us away from this. And I pushed the curtain. There was no one there. For a whole minute, we couldn't believe our own eyes. The whole thing was so surreal, we just knew that it wasn't our imagination, but we continued to explore the hospital. As we went to the entrance hall, where we had started, we noticed that the elevators were functioning because their doors were open on this floor. They weren't before. Fucking Jacob, right? We entered one of them and got to the second floor, less trouble than walking up the stairs. As the doors opened, we heard a crash and a scream at the same time, coming from the end of the corridor. The crash was something metallic being thrown like a gurney, and the scream. Holy shit. Even thinking about it now gives me shivers.
I swear to God, whatever screamed didn't sound alive. It sounded like an animal screaming, but it wasn't human for sure. We should have gotten away at that moment. For some reason that we don't even understand now, we stayed. Fucking Jacob pranking us, we thought. Every step, the dread feeling grew in us. His hand was as cold as mine, and we were both shaking. It was dark, the flashlights being our only source of light, and then, like, flickered and turned off. The last thing we saw was someone at the end of the corridor staring at us, running to get us in a speed no human could reach. We ran to the elevator and pressed the first floor button, as crazy people usually do. I was about to cry, and although he likes to pretend he wasn't, Gerard was too, because that thing was getting closer and closer. It looked like a human, but too pale, too thin, and wore a hospital gown that was too large for its bony body. I couldn't see its face clearly, but I was sure it didn't have eyes, but still looked at us directly somehow. It wasn't looking at my soul. It wanted to devour it. I felt it. Dear Lord. The doors were closing when it reached us. Its long claw-like fingers tried to stop it from closing, but the door slided anyway, cutting off the creature's fingers. I was about to cry right then, because that scene, I just can't forget it. The fingers laid on the floor, and they didn't bleed, but dripped a black liquid that smelled putrid like death and decay, but 10 times worse. We ran outside, holding each other, as if it would protect us. We climbed up the fence and ran to his house without even looking back. We were afraid that if we looked back, we would see it again. We've been there since, sleeping in turns. I lied to my parents to trick them into thinking we're dating so that I could sleep here without problems. I don't want to get them involved. I'm telling you this because I want to warn you. They found Jacob's body this morning. He died on Friday. He was already dead when we entered the building. It wasn't him. And so who or what was there hunting us? We don't know. We're trying to get help, but while nothing happens, I want to warn you, don't ever enter a building whose past you don't know. You never know what you're going to find there. The Strange Dark Hill. It's a strangely dark hill in the northwestern part of Browston, Massachusetts. It's been that way for a very long time, as far as anyone can tell. I avoid it, personally. It's on Turkey Road, just off of Agawam. I don't think I'd avoid it if there were ever a real reason to go out in that direction. But the folklore surrounding it, combined with its relative uselessness, makes it easy to avoid and ignore. I remember hearing about it when I was a little. However, vaguely, something about a school bus getting stuck on the hill. My friend John had told me about it one day while we were on the bus, which lent it some vividness. Later on in the 5th grade, I heard about it in more detail from Leo. He was a talkative sort, and I think he prided himself on his knowledge of these sorts of things. He also told my crush I liked it without my permission, but that's another story. Leo mentioned that during a particularly cold and icy winter morning in 1978, a school bus stalled on the top of the Turkey Road Hill. There were 13 students on board. Having stalled, the heater stopped working. The bus driver tried to radio for help, but couldn't reach anybody. The bus got colder and colder, sitting in the shade at the top of the hill. The students were okay, mostly kids. They do great in the cold. They jumped around and distracted themselves. Well, the bus driver got more and more concerned. Not a single car had gone by them since they stalled. It was not a busy road by any means, but traffic being this scarce was unusual. She tried to radio again, but only got back static. School was starting by now, and the principal and the teachers would start to worry. She took some comfort in that, but she could still see her breath. One of the students came up to her and asked whether they'd be on their way soon. She said she hoped so, but wasn't sure. She also mentioned that she was sure if the bus didn't start soon, the school would send someone to check on them. The student went back to his seat. The bus driver looked around and noticed the students weren't playing anymore. They seemed to be feeling the cold more than she'd hoped they would. Some were shivering, rubbing their arms and breathing into their cupped hands. Others were pulling their arms into their shirts to conserve their body heat. She began to worry more. She tried to start the bus again, but it made a violent clicking whirring and lunged forward slightly toward the icy downward slope of the hill before coming to a slow stop. She felt like they were too close to the steep hill at this point. Her emergency brake was pulling, but that would do precious little good were they to slide on an icy patch. And if that happened, they'd slide all the way down. At the bottom of the hill was a sharp right turn, but were they sliding that turn would be an impossibility, and they'd slide directly into the frozen swamp of a pond directly beyond it. She noticed a child stand and start jumping to keep warm. The bus trembled under her steady and rhythmic jumping.
Another student stood and joined in, synchronizing his jumps to the first student. The bus shook a little more. The bus driver told them to stop, but they moaned that they had to keep warm. Another joined in, and another, all jumping in unison, and shouting that they had to keep warm. Soon, almost half of the students were jumping, and the bus was rocking. The bus driver was yelling at this point for them to keep still, but they ignored her. More and more joined, all were yelling in a sort of frenzy, and the bus rocked more and more heavily. 12 were jumping when the bus driver felt the bus began to slide. Slowly at first, the 13th, the last, stood and jumped, and the bus broke forth, sliding down the hill. The bus driver slammed the brakes, released and pulled the emergency brake, and tried turning the wheel in every conceivable way, but no such luck. The bus sped down the icy hill in spite of her. She watched out the back of the bus in horror as they moved closer and closer to the pond at the bottom of the hill. From beyond the curve sped a police cruiser, looking for the selfsame bus that now bore down on him. He slammed his brakes and spun out just as the bus slammed into him and flipped over, landing firmly in the frozen pond. Now broken through, and the bus and cruiser began to sink. Many had died in the crash, but many had survived, injured and screaming, as the bus sank down into the icy water. That's the story Leo told me. Turkey Road Hill has since been part of the local mythology of Boston, being thought of by many as incredibly haunted. I don't believe it personally. I've been there before. One of the usual dare teenagers give one another. I went there at midnight, and while it was unusually dark, I had no strange experiences. I did hear the shrieking of spring peepers, being of that season, but surely the shrieks of children, even muffled by the walls of a bus, could rise above those. Now that I think more clearly about it, though, I did feel the ground tremble slightly as I stood near the top of the hill. It was a rhythmic shaking, and I made note of how unusual and rare it was for there to be an earthquake in Massachusetts. But I'm sure it was only that.